Chapter 69. Nearly asphyxiated by fumes, Langdon struggled up the ladder toward the light at the top of the pit. Above him he heard voices, but nothing was making sense. His head was spinning with images of the branded cardinal. Earth! Earth! As he pushed upward, his vision narrowed, and he feared consciousness would slip away. Two rungs from the top, his balance faltered. He lunged upward, trying to find the lip, but it was too far. He lost his grip on the ladder and almost tumbled backward into the dark. There was a sharp pain under his arms, and suddenly Langdon was airborne, legs swinging wildly out over the chasm. The strong hands of two Swiss guards hooked him under the armpits and dragged him skyward. A moment later, Langdon's head emerged from the demon's hole, choking and gasping for air. The guards dragged him over the lip of the opening, across the floor, and laid him down, back against the cold marble floor. For a moment, Langdon was unsure where he was. Overhead, he saw stars, orbiting planets. Hazy figures raced past him. People were shouting. He tried to sit up. He was lying at the base of a stone pyramid. The familiar bite of an angry tongue echoed inside the chapel, and then Langdon knew. Olivetti was screaming at Vittoria. "Why the hell didn't you figure that out in the first place?" Vittoria was trying to explain the situation. Olivetti cut her off mid-sentence and turned to bark orders to his men. "Get that body out of there! Search the rest of the building!" Langdon tried to sit up. The Chigi chapel was packed with Swiss guards. The plastic curtain over the chapel opening had been torn off the entryway, and fresh air filled Langdon's lungs. As his senses slowly returned, Langdon saw Vittoria coming toward him. She knelt down, her face like an angel. "You okay?" Vittoria took his arm and felt his pulse. Her hands were tender on his skin. "Thanks," Langdon sat up fully. "Olivetti's mad." Vittoria nodded. "He has a right to be. We blew it."
"You mean I blew it?"
"So redeem yourself. Get him next time."
"Next time?" Langdon thought it was a cruel comment. "There is no next time. We missed our shot."
Vittoria checked Langdon's watch. "Mickey says we've got 40 minutes. Get your head together and help me find the next marker."
"I told you, Vittoria, the sculptures are gone. The path of illumination is..."
Langdon halted. Vittoria smiled softly. Suddenly Langdon was staggering to his feet. He turned, dizzying circles, staring at the artwork around him. Pyramids, stars, planets, ellipses. Suddenly everything came back. This is the first altar of science, not the Pantheon. It dawned on him now how perfectly Illuminati the chapel was, far more subtle and selective than the world-famous Pantheon. The Chigi was an out-of-the-way alcove, a literal hole in the wall, a tribute to a great patron of science, decorated with earthly symbology. Perfect! Langdon steadied himself against the wall and gazed up at the enormous pyramid sculptures. Vittoria was dead right. If this chapel was the first altar of science, it might still contain the Illuminati sculpture that served as the first marker. Langdon felt an electrifying rush of hope to realize there was still a chance. If the marker were indeed here, and they could follow it to the next altar of science, they might have another chance to catch the killer. Vittoria moved closer. "I found out who the unknown Illuminati sculptor was." Langdon's head whipped around.
"You what?"
"Now we just need to figure out which sculpture in here is the..."
"Wait a minute. You know who the Illuminati sculptor was?"
He had spent years trying to find that information. Vittoria smiled. "It was Bernini." She paused. "The Bernini." Langdon immediately knew she was mistaken. Bernini was an impossibility. Gian Lorenzo Bernini was the second most famous sculptor of all time, his fame eclipsed only by Michelangelo himself. During the 1600s, Bernini created more sculptures than any other artist. Unfortunately, the man they were looking for was supposedly an unknown, a nobody. Vittoria frowned. "You don't look excited."
"Bernini is impossible."
"Why? Bernini was a contemporary of Galileo.
He was a brilliant sculptor. He was a very famous man, and a Catholic.
Yes, Vittoria said, exactly like Galileo.
No, Langdon argued, nothing like Galileo. Galileo was the thorn in the Vatican's side. Bernini was the Vatican's wonder boy. The church loved Bernini. He was elected the Vatican's overall artistic authority. He practically lived inside Vatican City his entire life.
The perfect cover. Illuminati infiltration.
Langdon felt flustered. Vittoria, the Illuminati members refer to their secret artist as El Maestro Ignoto, the unknown master.
Yes, unknown to them. Think of the secrecy of the Masons. Only the upper echelon members knew the whole truth.
Galileo could have kept Bernini's true identity secret from most members, for Bernini's own safety. That way the Vatican would never find out. Langdon was unconvinced, but had to admit Vittoria's logic made strange sense. The Illuminati were famous for keeping secret information compartmentalized, only revealing the truth to upper-level members. It was the cornerstone of their ability to stay secret. Very few knew the whole story.
And Bernini's affiliation with the Illuminati, Vittoria added with a smile, explains why he designed those two pyramids.
Langdon turned to the huge sculpted pyramids and shook his head.
Bernini was a religious sculptor. There's no way he carved those pyramids.
Vittoria shrugged. Tell that to the sign behind you.
Langdon turned to the plaque. Art of the Chigi Chapel. While the architecture is Raphael's, all interior adornments are those of Gian Lorenzo Bernini.
Langdon read the plaque twice, and still he was not convinced. Gian Lorenzo Bernini was celebrated for his intricate, holy sculptures of the Virgin Mary, angels, prophets, popes. What was he doing carving pyramids?
Langdon looked up at the towering monuments and felt totally disoriented. Two pyramids, each with a shining elliptical medallion. They were about as unchristian as sculpture could get. The pyramids, the stars above, the signs of the zodiac. All interior adornments are those of Gian Lorenzo Bernini. If that were true, Langdon realized, it meant Vittoria had to be right. By default, Bernini was the Illuminati's unknown master. Nobody else had contributed artwork to this chapel. The implications came almost too fast for Langdon to process. Bernini was an Illuminatus. Bernini designed the Illuminati ambigrams. Bernini laid out the path of illumination. Langdon could barely speak. Could it be that here, in this tiny Chigi Chapel, the world-renowned Bernini had placed a sculpture that pointed across Rome toward the next altar of science?
Bernini, he said, I would never have guessed.
Who other than a famous Vatican artist would have had the clout to put his artwork in specific Catholic chapels around Rome and create the path of illumination? Certainly not an unknown.
Langdon considered it. He looked at the pyramids, wondering if one of them could somehow be the marker.
Maybe both of them.
The pyramids face opposite directions, Langdon said, not sure what to make of them. They're also identical, so I don't know which.
I don't think the pyramids are what we're looking for.
But they're the only sculptures here.
Vittoria cut him off by pointing toward Olivetti and some of his guards who were gathered near the demon's hole.
Langdon followed the line of her hand to the far wall. At first he saw nothing. Then someone moved and he caught a glimpse. White marble, an arm, a torso, and then a sculpted face, partially hidden in its niche. Two life-size human figures intertwined. Langdon's pulse accelerated. He had been so taken with the pyramids and Demon's Hole, he hadn't even seen the sculpture. He moved across the room through the crowd. As he drew near, Langdon recognized the work was pure Bernini. The intensity of the artistic composition, the intricate faces and flowing clothing, all from the purest white marble Vatican money could buy. It was not until he was almost directly in front of it that Langdon recognized the sculpture itself. He stared up at the two faces and gasped. Who are they? Vittoria urged, arriving behind him.
Langdon stood astonished.
Habakkuk and the angel, he said, his voice almost inaudible.
The piece was a fairly well-known Bernini work that was included in some art history texts. Langdon had forgotten it was here.
Habakkuk?
Yes, the prophet who predicted the annihilation of the earth. Vittoria looked uneasy.
You think this is the marker?
Langdon nodded in amazement. Never in his life had he been so sure of anything. This was the first Illuminati marker, no doubt. Although Langdon had fully expected the sculpture to somehow point to the next altar of science, he did not expect it to be literal. Both the angel and Habakkuk had their arms outstretched and were pointing into the distance. Langdon found himself suddenly smiling.
Not too subtle, is it?
Vittoria looked excited but confused.
I see them pointing, but they are contradicting each other. The angel is pointing one way and the prophet the other.
Langdon chuckled. It was true. Although both figures were pointing into the distance, they were pointing in totally opposite directions. Langdon, however, had already solved that problem. With a burst of energy, he headed for the door.
Where are you going? Vittoria called.
Outside the building.
Langdon's legs felt light again as he ran toward the door.
I need to see what direction that sculpture is pointing. Wait! How do you know which finger to follow?
The poem, he called over his shoulder. The last line.
Let angels guide you on your lofty quest?
She gazed upward at the outstretched finger of the angel. Her eyes misted unexpectedly.
Well, I'll be damned.
Chapter 70 Gunther Glick and Shanita Macri sat parked in the BBC van in the shadows at the far end of the Piazza del Popolo. They had arrived shortly after the four Alfa Romeos, just in time to witness an inconceivable chain of events. Shanita still had no idea what it all meant, but she'd made sure the camera was rolling. As soon as they'd arrived, Shanita and Glick had seen a veritable army of young men pour out of the Alfa Romeos and surround the church. Some had weapons drawn. One of them, a stiff older man, led a team up the front steps of the church. The soldiers drew guns and blew the locks off the front doors. Macri heard nothing and figured they must have had silencers. Then the soldiers entered. Shanita had recommended they sit tight and film from the shadows. After all, guns were guns, and they had a clear view of the action from the van. Glick hadn't argued. Now, across the piazza, men moved in and out of the church. They yelled to each other. Shanita adjusted her camera to follow a team as they searched the surrounding area. All of them, though dressed in civilian clothes, seemed to move with military precision.
"Who do you think they are?" she asked.
"Hell if I know," Glick looked riveted.
"You getting all this?"
"Every frame."
Glick sounded smug.
"Still think we should go back to Pope Watch?"
Shanita wasn't sure what to say. There was obviously something going on here, but she had been in journalism long enough to know that there was often a very dull explanation for interesting events.
"This could be nothing," she said. "These guys could have gotten the same tip you got and are just checking it out. Could be a false alarm."
Glick grabbed her arm.
"Over there! Focus!"
He pointed back to the church. Shanita swung the camera back to the top of the stairs.
"Hello there," she said, training on the man now emerging from the church.
"Who's the dapper?"
Shanita moved in for a close-up.
"Haven't seen him before."
She tightened in on the man's face and smiled.
"But I wouldn't mind seeing him again."
Robert Langdon dashed down the stairs outside the church and into the middle of the piazza. It was getting dark now, the springtime sun setting late in southern Rome. The sun had dropped below the surrounding buildings, and shadows streaked the square.
"Okay, Bernini," he said aloud to himself. "Where the hell is your angel pointing?"
He turned and examined the orientation of the church from which he had just come. He pictured the Chigi Chapel inside, and the sculpture of the angel inside that. Without hesitation, he turned due west into the glow of the impending sunset. Time was evaporating. "Southwest," he said, scowling at the shops and apartments blocking his view. "The next marker is out there." Racking his brain, Langdon pictured page after page of Italian art history. Although very familiar with Bernini's work, Langdon knew the sculptor had been far too prolific for any non-specialist to know all of it. Still considering the relative fame of the first marker, Habakkuk and the Angel, Langdon hoped the second marker was a work he might know from memory. "Earth, air, fire, water," he thought. Earth they had found, inside the chapel of Earth. Habakkuk the prophet, who predicted the Earth's annihilation. "Air is next," Langdon urged himself to think. "A Bernini sculpture that has something to do with air." He was drawing a total blank. Still, he felt energized. "I'm on the path of illumination. It is still intact." Looking southwest, Langdon strained to see a spire or cathedral tower jutting up over the obstacles. He saw nothing. He needed a map. If they could figure out what churches were southwest of here, maybe one of them would spark Langdon's memory. "Air," he pressed. "Air. Bernini. Sculpture. Air. Think." Langdon turned and headed back up the cathedral stairs. He was met beneath the scaffolding by Vittoria and Olivetti. "Southwest," Langdon said, panting. "The next church is southwest of here." Olivetti's whisper was cold. "You sure this time?" Langdon didn't bite. "We need a map, one that shows all the churches in Rome." The commander studied him a moment, his expression never changing. Langdon checked his watch. "We only have half an hour." Olivetti moved past Langdon down the stairs toward his car, parked directly in front of the cathedral. Langdon hoped he was going for a map. Vittoria looked excited. "So the angel's pointing southwest? No idea which churches are southwest?" "I can't see past the damn buildings." Langdon turned and faced the square again. "And I don't know Rome's churches well in—" He stopped. Vittoria looked startled. "What?" Langdon looked out of the piazza again. Having ascended the church stairs, he was now higher, and his view was better. He still couldn't see anything, but he realized he was moving in the right direction. His eyes climbed the tower of rickety scaffolding above him. It rose 6 stories, almost to the top of the church's rose window, far higher than the other buildings in the square. He knew in an instant where he was headed. Across the square, Chinita Macri and Gunther Glick sat glued to the windshield of the BBC van. "You getting this?" Gunther asked. Macri tightened her shot on the man now climbing the scaffolding. "He's a little well-dressed to be playing Spider-Man, if you ask me." "And who's Ms. Spidey?" Chinita glanced at the attractive woman beneath the scaffolding. "But you'd like to find out." "Think I should call editorial?" "Not yet. Let's watch. Better to have something in the can before we admit we abandoned Conclave." "You think somebody really killed one of the old farts in there?" Chinita clucked. "You're definitely going to hell. And I'll be taking the Pulitzer with me." Chapter 71 The scaffolding seemed less stable the higher Langdon climbed. His view of Rome, however, got better with every step. He continued upward. He was breathing harder than he expected when he reached the upper tier. He pulled himself onto the last platform, brushed off the plaster, and stood up. The height didn't bother him at all. In fact, it was invigorating. The view was staggering. Like an ocean on fire, the red-tiled rooftops of Rome spread out before him, glowing in the scarlet sunset. From that spot, for the first time in his life, Langdon saw beyond the pollution and traffic of Rome to its ancient roots, Città di Dio, the City of God. Squinting into the sunset, Langdon scanned the rooftops for a church steeple or bell tower. But as he looked farther and farther toward the horizon, he saw nothing. "There are hundreds of churches in Rome," he thought. "There must be one southwest of here. If the church is even visible," he reminded himself. "Hell, if the church is even still standing." Forcing his eyes to trace the line slowly, he attempted the search again. He knew, of course, that not all churches would have visible spires, especially smaller, out-of-the-way sanctuaries. Not to mention Rome had changed dramatically since the 1600s, when churches were, by law, the tallest buildings allowed. Now, as Langdon looked out, he saw apartment buildings, high-rises, TV towers. For the second time, Langdon's eye reached the horizon without seeing anything. Not one single spire. In the distance, on the very edge of Rome, Michelangelo's massive dome blotted the setting sun. St. Peter's Basilica, Vatican City. Langdon found himself wondering how the cardinals were faring, and if the Swiss Guard's search had turned up the antimatter. Something told him it hadn't, and wouldn't. The poem was rattling through his head again. He considered it carefully, line by line. From Santi's earthly tomb with demons whole. They had found Santi's tomb. Cross Rome, the mystic elements unfold. The mystic elements were earth, air, fire, water. The path of light is laid, the sacred test. The path of illumination formed by Bernini's sculptures. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. The angel was pointing southwest. "Front stairs!" Glick exclaimed, pointing wildly through the windshield of the BBC van. "Something's going on!" Macri dropped her shot back down to the main entrance. Something was definitely going on. At the bottom of the stairs, the military-looking man had pulled one of the Alfa Romeos close to the stairs and opened the trunk. Now he was scanning the square, as if checking for onlookers. For a moment, Macri thought the man had spotted them, but his eyes kept moving. Apparently satisfied, he pulled out a walkie-talkie and spoke into it. Almost instantly, it seemed an army emerged from the church. Like an American football team breaking from a huddle, the soldiers formed a straight line across the top of the stairs. Moving like a human wall, they began to descend. Behind them, almost entirely hidden by the wall, four soldiers seemed to be carrying something. Something heavy, awkward. Glick leaned forward on the dashboard. "Are they stealing something from the church?" Janita tightened her shot even more, using the telephoto to probe the wall of men, looking for an opening. "One split second," she willed. "A single frame. That's all I need." But the men moved as one. "Come on!" Macri stayed with them, and it paid off. When the soldiers tried to lift the object into the trunk, Macri found her opening. Ironically, it was the older man who faltered. Only for an instant, but long enough, Macri had her frame. Actually, it was more like 10 frames. "Call editorial," Shanita said. "We've got a dead body." Far away, at CERN, Maximilian Kohler maneuvered his wheelchair into Leonardo Vetra's study. With mechanical efficiency, he began sifting through Vetra's files. Not finding what he was after, Kohler moved to Vetra's bedroom. The top drawer of his bedside table was locked. Kohler pried it open with a knife from the kitchen. Inside, Kohler found exactly what he was looking for. Chapter 72. Langdon swung off the scaffolding and dropped back to the ground. He brushed the plaster dust from his clothes. Vittoria was there to greet him. "No luck?" she said. He shook his head. "They put the cardinal in the trunk." Langdon looked over to the parked car, where Olivetti and a group of soldiers now had a map spread out on the hood. "Are they looking southwest?" She nodded. "No churches. From here, the first one you hit is St. Peter's." Langdon grunted. At least they were in agreement. He moved toward Olivetti. The soldiers parted to let him through. Olivetti looked up. "Nothing. But this doesn't show every last church, just the big ones. About 50 of them." "Where are we?" Langdon asked. Olivetti pointed to Piazza del Popolo and traced a straight line exactly southwest. The line missed, by a substantial margin, the cluster of black squares indicating Rome's major churches. Unfortunately, Rome's major churches were also Rome's older churches, those that would have been around in the 1600s.
"I've got some decisions to make," Olivetti said. "Are you certain of the direction?"
Langdon pictured the angel's outstretched finger, the urgency rising in him again.
"Yes, sir, positive."
Olivetti shrugged and traced the straight line again. The path intersected the Margherita Bridge, Via Colla di Rialto, and passed through Piazza del Risorgimento, hitting no churches at all, until it dead-ended abruptly at the center of St. Peter's Square.
"What's wrong with St. Peter's?" one of the soldiers said. He had a deep scar under his left eye. "It's a church?"
Langdon shook his head.
"Needs to be a public place. Hardly seems public at the moment."
"But the line goes through St. Peter's Square," Vittoria added, looking over Langdon's shoulder. "The square is public."
Langdon had already considered it.
"No statues, though."
"Isn't there a monolith in the middle?"
She was right. There was an Egyptian monolith in St. Peter's Square. Langdon looked out at the monolith in the piazza in front of them, the lofty pyramid. An odd coincidence, he thought. He shook it off.
"The Vatican's monolith is not by Bernini. It was brought in by Caligula, and it has nothing to do with air."
And there was another problem as well. Besides, the poem says the elements are spread across Rome. St. Peter's Square is in Vatican City, not Rome.
"Depends on who you ask,"
a guard interjected. Langdon looked up.
"What?"
"Always a bone of contention. Most maps show St. Peter's Square as part of Vatican City, but it's outside the walled city. Roman officials for centuries have claimed it as part of Rome."
"You're kidding," Langdon said. He had never known that.
"I only mention it," the guard continued, "because Commander Olivetti and Miss Vetra were asking about a sculpture that had to do with air."
Langdon was wide-eyed. "And you know of one in St. Peter's Square?"
"Not exactly. It's not really a sculpture.
Probably not relevant."
"Let's hear it," Olivetti pressed. The guard shrugged. "The only reason I know about it is because I'm usually on piazza duty. I know every corner of St. Peter's Square."
"The sculpture," Langdon urged. "What does it look like?"
Langdon was starting to wonder if the Illuminati could really have been gutsy enough to position their second marker right outside St. Peter's Church.
"I patrol past it every day," the guard said. "It's in the center, directly where that line is pointing. That's what made me think of it. As I said, it's not really a sculpture. It's more of a block."
Olivetti looked mad.
"A block?"
"Yes, sir. A marble block embedded in the square, at the base of the monolith. But the block is not a rectangle, it's an ellipse. And the block is carved with the image of a billowing gust of wind." He paused.
"Air, I suppose, if you wanted to get scientific about it."
Langdon stared at the young soldier in amazement.
"A relief?"
he exclaimed suddenly. Everyone looked at him.
"Relief," Langdon said, "is the other half of the sculpture."
"Sculpture is the art of shaping figures in the round and also in relief." He had written the definition on chalkboards for years. Reliefs were essentially two-dimensional sculptures, like Abraham Lincoln's profile on the penny. Bernini's Chigi Chapel medallions were another perfect example.
"Basso rilievo?"
the guard asked, using the Italian art term.
"Yes. Bas-relief."
Langdon rapped his knuckles on the hood.
"I wasn't thinking in those terms. That tile you're talking about in St. Peter's Square is called the West Ponente, the West Wind. It's also known as Respiro di Dio."
"Breath of God?"
"Yes, air. And it was carved and put there by the original architect."
Vittoria looked confused.
"But I thought Michelangelo designed St. Peter's."
"Yes, the Basilica," Langdon exclaimed, triumph in his voice. "But St. Peter's Square was designed by Bernini."
As the caravan of Alfa Romeos tore out of Piazza del Popolo, everyone was in too much of a hurry to notice the BBC van pulling out behind them. Chapter 73 Gunther Glick floored the BBC van's accelerator and swerved through traffic as he tailed the four speeding Alfa Romeos across the Tiber River on Ponte Margherita. Normally, Glick would have made an effort to maintain an inconspicuous distance, but today he could barely keep up. These guys were flying. Macri sat in her work area in the back of the van, finishing a phone call with London. She hung up and yelled to Glick over the sound of the traffic. "You want the good news or the bad news?" Glick frowned. Nothing was ever simple when dealing with the Home Office. "Bad news. Editorial is burned. We abandoned our post." "Surprise. They also think your tipster is a fraud." "Of course. And the boss just warned me that you're a few crumpets short of a proper tea." Glick scowled. "Great. And the good news?" "They agreed to look at the footage we just shot." Glick felt his scowl soften into a grin. "I guess we'll see who's short a few crumpets. So fire it off." "Can't transmit until we stop and get a fixed cell read." Glick gunned the van onto Via Colla del Rialto. "Can't stop now." He tailed the Alfa Romeos through a hard-left swerve around Piazza Risorgimento. Macri held onto her computer gear and back as everything slid. "Break my transmitter," she warned, "and we'll have to walk this footage to London." "Sit tight, love. Something tells me we're almost there." Macri looked up.
"Where?"
Glick gazed out at the familiar dome now looming directly in front of him. He smiled. "Right back where we started." The four Alfa Romeos slipped deftly into traffic surrounding St. Peter's Square. They split up and spread out along the piazza perimeter, quietly unloading men at select points. The debarking guards moved into the throng of tourists and media vans on the edge of the square and instantly became invisible. Some of the guards entered the forest of pillars encompassing the colonnade. They, too, seemed to evaporate into the surroundings. As Langdon watched through the windshield, he sensed a noose tightening around St. Peter's. In addition to the men Olivetti had just dispatched, the commander had radioed ahead to the Vatican and sent additional undercover guards to the center, where Bernini's West Ponente was located. As Langdon looked out at the wide-open spaces of St. Peter's Square, a familiar question nagged. How does the Illuminati assassin plan to get away with this? How will he get a cardinal through all these people and kill him in plain view? Langdon checked his Mickey Mouse watch. It was 8:54 p.m. 6 minutes. In the front seat, Olivetti turned and faced Langdon and Vittoria. "I want you two right on top of this Bernini brick or block or whatever the hell it is. Same drill. You're tourists. Use the phone if you see anything." Before Langdon could respond, Vittoria had his hand and was pulling him out of the car. The springtime sun was setting behind St. Peter's Basilica, and a massive shadow spread, engulfing the piazza. Langdon felt an ominous chill as he and Vittoria moved into the cool black umbra. Snaking through the crowd, Langdon found himself searching every face they passed, wondering if the killer was among them. Vittoria's hand felt warm. As they crossed the open expanse of St. Peter's Square, Langdon sensed Bernini's sprawling piazza having the exact effect the artist had been commissioned to create, that of humbling all those who entered. Langdon certainly felt humbled at the moment. Humbled and hungry, he realized, surprised such a mundane thought could enter his head at a moment like this. "To the obelisk?" Vittoria asked. Langdon nodded, arcing left across the piazza. "Time?" Vittoria asked, walking briskly but casually. "Five of." Vittoria said nothing, but Langdon felt her grip tighten. He was still carrying the gun. He hoped Vittoria wouldn't decide she needed it. He could not imagine her whipping out a weapon in St. Peter's Square and blowing away the kneecaps of some killer while the global media looked on. Then again, an incident like that would be nothing compared to the branding and murder of a cardinal out here. Air, Langdon thought, the second element of science. He tried to picture the brand, the method of murder. Again he scanned the sprawling expanse of granite beneath his feet. St. Peter's Square. An open desert surrounded by Swiss Guard. If the Hashashin really dared attempt this, Langdon couldn't imagine how he would escape.
In the center of the piazza rose Caligula's 350-ton Egyptian obelisk. It stretched 81 feet skyward to the pyramidal apex, onto which was affixed a hollow iron cross. Sufficiently high to catch the last of the evening sun, the cross shone as if magic, purportedly containing relics of the cross on which Christ was crucified. Two fountains flanked the obelisk in perfect symmetry. Art historians knew the fountains marked the exact geometric focal points of Bernini's elliptical piazza, but it was an architectural oddity Langdon had never really considered until today. It seemed Rome was suddenly filled with ellipses, pyramids, and startling geometry. As they neared the obelisk, Vittoria slowed. She exhaled heavily, as if coaxing Langdon to relax along with her. Langdon made the effort, lowering his shoulders and loosening his clenched jaw. Somewhere around the obelisk, boldly positioned outside the largest church in the world, was the second altar of science, Bernini's West Ponente, an elliptical block in St. Peter's Square. Gunther Glick watched from the shadows of the pillars surrounding St. Peter's Square. On any other day, the man in the tweed jacket and the woman in khaki shorts would not have interested him in the least. They appeared to be nothing but tourists enjoying the square. But today was not any other day. Today had been a day of phone tips, corpses, unmarked cars racing through Rome, and men in tweed jackets climbing scaffolding in search of God only knew what. Glick would stay with them. He looked out across the square and saw Macri. She was exactly where he had told her to go, on the far side of the couple, hovering on their flank. Macri carried her video camera casually, but despite her imitation of a bored member of the press, she stood out more than Glick would have liked. No other reporters were in this far corner of the square, and the acronym BBC stenciled on her camera was drawing some looks from tourists. The tape Macri had shot earlier of the naked body dumped in the trunk was playing at this very moment on the VCR transmitter back in the van. Glick knew the images were sailing over his head right now, en route to London. He wondered what editorial would say. He wished he and Macri had reached the body sooner, before the army of plain-clothed soldiers had intervened. The same army, he knew, had now fanned out and surrounded this piazza. Something big was about to happen. "The media is the right arm of anarchy," the killer had said. Glick wondered if he had missed his chance for a big scoop. He looked out at the other media vans in the distance and watched Macri tailing the mysterious couple across the piazza. Something told Glick he was still in the game. Chapter 74. Langdon saw what he was looking for a good 10 yards before they reached it. Through the scattered tourists, the white marble ellipse of Bernini's West Ponente stood out against the gray granite cubes that make up the rest of the piazza. Vittoria apparently saw it too, her hand tensed. "Relax," Langdon whispered. "Do your piranha thing." Vittoria loosened her grip. As they drew nearer, everything seemed forbiddingly normal. Tourists wandered, nuns chatted along the perimeter of the piazza. A girl fed pigeons at the base of the obelisk. Langdon refrained from checking his watch. He knew it was almost time. The elliptical stone arrived beneath their feet, and Langdon and Vittoria slowed to a stop, not over-eagerly, just two tourists pausing dutifully at a point of mild interest. "West Ponente," Vittoria said, reading the inscription on the stone. Langdon gazed down at the marble relief and felt suddenly naive. Not in his art books, not in his numerous trips to Rome, not ever had West Ponente's significance jumped out at him. Not until now. The relief was elliptical, about 3 feet long, and carved with a rudimentary face, a depiction of the west wind as an angel-like countenance.
Gusting from the angel's mouth, Bernini had drawn a powerful breath of air, blowing outward, away from the Vatican. The breath of God. This was Bernini's tribute to the second element. Air. An ethereal zephyr blown from an angel's lips. As Langdon stared, he realized the significance of the relief went deeper still. Bernini had carved the air in five distinct gusts. Five. What was more, flanking the medallion were two shining stars. Langdon thought of Galileo. Two stars, five gusts, ellipses, symmetry. He felt hollow. His head hurt. Vittoria began walking again almost immediately, leading Langdon away from the relief.
"I think someone's following us," she said.
Langdon looked up.
"Where?"
Vittoria moved a good 30 yards before speaking. She pointed up at the Vatican as if showing Langdon something on the dome.
"The same person has been behind us all the way across the square."
Casually, Vittoria glanced over her shoulder.
"Still on us. Keep moving."
"You think it's the Hashashin?"
Vittoria shook her head. "Not unless the Illuminati hires women with BBC cameras." When the bells of St. Peter's began their deafening clamor, both Langdon and Vittoria jumped. It was time. They had circled away from West Ponente in an attempt to lose the reporter, but were now moving back toward the relief. Despite the clanging bells, the area seemed perfectly calm. Tourists wandered. A homeless drunk dozed awkwardly at the base of the obelisk. A little girl fed pigeons. Langdon wondered if the reporter had scared the killer off. "Doubtful," he decided, recalling the killer's promise. "I will make your cardinals media luminaries." As the echo of the ninth bell faded away, a peaceful silence descended across the square. Then the little girl began to scream. Chapter 75. Langdon was the first to reach the screaming girl. The terrified youngster stood frozen, pointing at the base of the obelisk where a shabby, decrepit drunk sat slumped on the stairs. The man was a miserable sight, apparently one of Rome's homeless. His gray hair hung in greasy strands in front of his face, and his entire body was wrapped in some sort of dirty cloth. The girl kept screaming as she scampered off into the crowd. Langdon felt an upsurge of dread as he dashed toward the invalid. There was a dark, widening stain spreading across the man's rags, fresh, flowing blood. Then it was as if everything happened at once. The old man seemed to crumble in the middle, tottering forward. Langdon lunged, but he was too late. The man pitched forward, toppled off the stairs, and hit the pavement face down, motionless. Langdon dropped to his knees. Vittoria arrived beside him. A crowd was gathering. Vittoria put her fingers on the man's throat from behind.
"There's a pulse," she declared. "Roll him."
Langdon was already in motion. Grasping the man's shoulders, he rolled the body. As he did, the loose rags seemed to slough away like dead flesh. The man flopped limp onto his back. Dead center of his naked chest was a wide area of charred flesh. Vittoria gasped and pulled back. Langdon felt paralyzed, pinned somewhere between nausea and awe. The symbol had a terrifying simplicity to it. Air.
"Air!" Vittoria choked. "It's him!"
Swiss guards appeared from out of nowhere, shouting orders, racing after an unseen assassin. Nearby, a tourist explained that only minutes ago, a dark-skinned man had been kind enough to help this poor, wheezing, homeless man across the square, even sitting a moment on the stairs with the invalid before disappearing back into the crowd. Vittoria ripped the rest of the rags off the man's abdomen. He had two deep puncture wounds, one on either side of the brand, just below his ribcage. She cocked the man's head back and began to administer mouth-to-mouth. Langdon wasn't prepared for what happened next. As Vittoria blew, the wounds on either side of the man's midsection hissed and sprayed blood into the air like blowholes on a whale. The salty liquid hit Langdon in the face.
Vittoria stopped short, looking horrified. "His lungs," she stammered. "They're punctured."
Langdon wiped his eyes as he looked down at the two perforations. The holes gurgled. The cardinal's lungs were destroyed. He was gone. Vittoria covered the body as the Swiss guards moved in. Langdon stood, disoriented. As he did, he saw her. The woman who had been following them earlier was crouched nearby. Her BBC video camera was shouldered, aimed, and running. She and Langdon locked eyes, and he knew she'd gotten it all. Then, like a cat, she bolted. Chapter 76. Chinita Macri was on the run. She had the story of her life. Her video camera felt like an anchor as she lumbered across St. Peter's Square, pushing through the gathering crowd. Everyone seemed to be moving in the opposite direction than her, toward the commotion. Macri was trying to get as far away as possible. The man in the tweed jacket had seen her, and now she sensed others were after her, men she couldn't see, closing in from all sides. Macri was still aghast from the images she had just recorded. She wondered if the dead man was really who she feared he was. Glick's mysterious phone contact suddenly seemed a little less crazy. As she hurried in the direction of the BBC van, a young man with a decidedly militaristic air emerged from the crowd before her. Their eyes met, and they both stopped. Like lightning, he raised a walkie-talkie and spoke into it. Then he moved toward her. Macri wheeled and doubled back into the crowd, her heart pounding. As she stumbled through the mass of arms and legs, she removed the spent video cassette from her camera. "Cellulose gold," she thought, tucking the tape under her belt, flush to her backside, and letting her coattails cover it. For once, she was glad she carried some extra weight. "Glick, where the hell are you?" Another soldier appeared to her left, closing in. Macri knew she had little time. She banked into the crowd again. Yanking a blank cartridge from her case, she slapped it into the camera. Then she prayed. She was 30 yards from the BBC van when the two men materialized directly in front of her, arms folded. She was going nowhere. "Film," one snapped. "Now." Macri recoiled, wrapping her arms protectively around her camera. "No chance." One of the men pulled aside his jacket, revealing a sidearm. "So, shoot me," Macri said, amazed by the boldness of her voice. "Film," the first one repeated. "Where the devil is Glick?" Macri stamped her foot and yelled as loudly as possible. "I am a professional videographer with the BBC. By Article 12 of the Free Press Act, this film is property of the British Broadcasting Corporation." The men didn't flinch. The one with the gun took a step toward her. "I am a lieutenant with the Swiss Guard, and by the holy doctrine governing the property on which you are now standing, you are subject to search and seizure." A crowd had started to gather now around them. Macri yelled, "I will not under any circumstances give you the film in this camera without speaking to my editor in London. I suggest you..." The guards ended it. One yanked the camera out of her hands. The other forcibly grabbed her by the arm and twisted her in the direction of the Vatican. "Grazie," he said, leading her through a jostling crowd. Macri prayed they wouldn't search her and find the tape. If she could somehow protect the film long enough to... Suddenly, the unthinkable happened. Someone in the crowd was groping under her coat. Macri felt the video yanked away from her. She wheeled, but swallowed her words. Behind her, a breathless Gunther Glick gave her a wink and dissolved back into the crowd. Chapter 77. Robert Langdon staggered into the private bathroom adjoining the office of the Pope. He dabbed the blood from his face and lips. The blood wasn't his own. It was that of Cardinal Lamassé, who had just died horribly in the crowded square outside the Vatican. Virgin sacrifices on the altars of science. So far, the Hashashin had made good on his threat.
Langdon felt powerless as he gazed into the mirror. His eyes were drawn, and stubble had begun to darken his cheeks. The room around him was immaculate and lavish, black marble with gold fixtures, cotton towels, and scented hand soaps. Langdon tried to rid his mind of the bloody brand he had just seen. Air. The image stuck. He had witnessed 3 ambigrams since waking up this morning, and he knew there were 2 more coming. Outside the door, it sounded as if Olivetti, the Camerlengo, and Captain Rocher were debating what to do next. Apparently the antimatter search had turned up nothing so far. Either the guards had missed the canister, or the intruder had gotten deeper inside the Vatican than Commander Olivetti had been willing to entertain. Langdon dried his hands and face. Then he turned and looked for a urinal. No urinal, just a bowl. He lifted the lid. As he stood there, tension ebbing from his body, a giddy wave of exhaustion shuddered through his core. The emotions knotting his chest were so many, so incongruous. He was fatigued, running on no food or sleep, walking the path of illumination, traumatized by 2 brutal murders. Langdon felt a deepening horror over the possible outcome of this drama. "Think," he told himself. His mind was blank. As he flushed, an unexpected realization hit him. This was the Pope's toilet, he thought. I just took a leak in the Pope's toilet. He had to chuckle. The Holy Throne. Chapter 78. In London, a BBC technician ejected a video cassette from a satellite receiver unit and dashed across the control room floor. She burst into the office of the editor-in-chief, slammed the video into his VCR, and pressed play. As the tape rolled, she told him about the conversation she had just had with Gunther Glick in Vatican City. In addition, BBC photo archives had just given her a positive ID on the victim in St. Peter's Square. When the editor-in-chief emerged from his office, he was ringing a cowbell. Everything in editorial stopped. "Live in 5," the man boomed. "On-air talent to prep. Media coordinators, I want your contacts online. We've got a story we're selling. And we've got film." The market coordinators grabbed their Rolodexes. "Film specs?" one of them yelled. 30-second trim," the chief replied. "Content? Live homicide." The coordinators looked encouraged. "Usage and licensing price? $1 million per." Heads shot up. "What? You heard me. I want top of the food chain. CNN, MSNBC, then the big 3. Offer a dial-in preview. Give them 5 minutes to piggyback before BBC runs it." "What the hell happened?" someone demanded. "The Prime Minister gets skinned alive?" The chief shook his head. "Better." At that exact instant, somewhere in Rome, the Hashashin enjoyed a fleeting moment of repose in a comfortable chair. He admired the legendary chamber around him. "I am sitting in the Church of Illumination," he thought. "The Illuminati lair." He could not believe it was still here after all of these centuries. Dutifully, he dialed the BBC reporter to whom he had spoken earlier. It was time. The world had yet to hear the most shocking news of all. Chapter 79. Vittoria Vetra sipped a glass of water and nibbled absently at some tea scones just set out by one of the Swiss guards. She knew she should eat, but she had no appetite. The office of the Pope was bustling now, echoing with tense conversations. Captain Rocher, Commander Olivetti, and 6 guards assessed the damage and debated the next move. Robert Langdon stood nearby, staring out at St. Peter's Square. He looked dejected. Vittoria walked over. "Ideas?" He shook his head. "Scone?" His mood seemed to brighten at the sight of food. "Hell yes, thanks." He ate voraciously. The conversation behind them went quiet suddenly when 2 Swiss guards escorted Camerlengo Ventresca through the door. If the Chamberlain had looked drained before, Vittoria thought, now he looked empty.
"What happened?"
the Camerlengo said to Olivetti. From the look on the Camerlengo's face, he appeared to have already been told the worst of it. Olivetti's official update sounded like a battlefield casualty report. He gave the facts with flat efficiency.
Cardinal Ebner was found dead in the church of Santa Maria del Popolo just after 8 o'clock. He had been suffocated and branded with the ambigrammatic word earth. Cardinal Lamassé was murdered in St. Peter's Square 10 minutes ago. He died of perforations to the chest. He was branded with the word air, also ambigrammatic. The killer escaped in both instances.
The Camerlengo crossed the room and sat heavily behind the Pope's desk. He bowed his head.
Cardinals Guidera and Baja, however, are still alive.
The Camerlengo's head shot up, his expression pained.
This is our consolation? Two cardinals have been murdered, Commander, and the other two will obviously not be alive much longer unless you find them.
We will find them, Olivetti assured. I am encouraged.
Encouraged? We've had nothing but failure.
Untrue. We've lost 2 battles, Signore, but we're winning the war. The Illuminati had intended to turn this evening into a media circus. So far we have thwarted their plan. Both cardinals' bodies have been recovered without incident.
In addition, Olivetti continued, Captain Rocher tells me he is making excellent headway on the antimatter search.
Captain Rocher stepped forward in his red beret. Vittoria thought he looked more human somehow than the other guards. Stern, but not so rigid. Rocher's voice was emotional and crystalline, like a violin.
I am hopeful we will have the canister for you within an hour, Signore.
Captain, the Camerlengo said, excuse me if I seem less than hopeful, but I was under the impression that a search of Vatican City would take far more time than we have.
A full search, yes. However, after assessing the situation, I am confident the antimatter canister is located in one of our white zones, those Vatican sectors accessible to public tours, the museums and St. Peter's Basilica, for example. We have already killed power in those zones and are conducting our scan.
You intend to search only a small percentage of Vatican City?
Yes, Signore. It is highly unlikely that an intruder gained access to the inner zones of Vatican City. The fact that the missing security camera was stolen from a public access area, a stairwell in one of the museums, clearly implies that the intruder had limited access. Therefore, he would only have been able to relocate the camera and antimatter in another public access area. It is these areas on which we are focusing our search.
But the intruder kidnapped 4 cardinals. That certainly implies deeper infiltration than we thought.
Not necessarily. We must remember that the cardinals spent much of today in the Vatican Museums and St. Peter's Basilica, enjoying those areas without the crowds. It is probable that the missing cardinals were taken in one of these areas.
But how were they removed from our walls?
We are still assessing that.
I see. The Camerlengo exhaled and stood up. He walked over to Olivetti.
Commander, I would like to hear your contingency plan for evacuation.
We are still formalizing that, Signore. In the meantime, I am faithful Captain Rocher will find the canister.
Rocher clicked his boots as if in appreciation of the vote of confidence.
My men have already scanned 2/3 of the white zones. Confidence is high.
The Camerlengo didn't appear to share that confidence. At that moment, the guard with the scar beneath one eye came through the door carrying a clipboard and a map. He strode toward Langdon.
Mr. Langdon, I have the information you requested on the West Ponente.
Langdon swallowed his scone.
Good, let's have a look.
The others kept talking while Vittoria joined Robert and the guard as they spread out the map on the Pope's desk. The soldier pointed to St. Peter's Square.
This is where we are.
The central line of West Ponente's breath points due east, directly away from Vatican City.
The guard traced a line with his finger from St. Peter's Square across the Tiber River and up into the heart of old Rome. As you can see, the line passes through almost all of Rome. There are about 20 Catholic churches that fall near this line. Langdon slumped.
20? Maybe more.
Do any of the churches fall directly on the line?
Some look closer than others,
the guard said, but translating the exact bearing of the West Ponente onto a map leaves margin for error. Langdon looked out at St. Peter's Square a moment. Then he scowled, stroking his chin.
How about fire? Any of them have Bernini artwork that has to do with fire?
Silence.
How about obelisks? He demanded. Are any of the churches located near obelisks?
The guard began checking the map. Vittoria saw a glimmer of hope in Langdon's eyes and realized what he was thinking.
He's right.
The first two markers had been located on or near piazzas that contained obelisks. Maybe obelisks were a theme. Soaring pyramids marking the Illuminati path? The more Vittoria thought about it, the more perfect it seemed. Four towering beacons rising over Rome to mark the altars of science.
It's a long shot, Langdon said. But I know that many of Rome's obelisks were erected or moved during Bernini's reign. He was no doubt involved in their placement.
Or, Vittoria added, Bernini could have placed his markers near existing obelisks.
Langdon nodded.
True.
Bad news, the guard said. No obelisks on the line.
He traced his finger across the map.
None even remotely close. Nothing.
Langdon sighed. Vittoria's shoulders slumped. She'd thought it was a promising idea. Apparently this wasn't going to be as easy as they'd hoped. She tried to stay positive.
Robert, think. You must know of a Bernini statue relating to fire. Anything at all.
Believe me, I've been thinking.
Bernini was incredibly prolific. Hundreds of works. I was hoping West Ponente would point to a single church, something that would ring a bell.
Fuoco, she pressed.
Fire.
No Bernini titles jump out?
Langdon shrugged. There's his famous sketches of fireworks, but they're not sculpture, and they're in Leipzig, Germany.
Vittoria frowned. And you're sure the breath is what indicates the direction?
You saw the relief, Vittoria. The design was totally symmetrical. The only indication of bearing was the breath.
Vittoria knew he was right. Not to mention, he added, because the West Ponente signifies air. Following the breath seems symbolically appropriate.
Vittoria nodded. So we follow the breath, but where?
Olivetti came over.
What have you got?
Too many churches, the soldier said. 2 dozen or so. I suppose we could put 4 men on each church.
Forget it, Olivetti said. We missed this guy twice when we knew exactly where he was going to be. A mass stakeout means leaving Vatican City unprotected and canceling the search.
We need a reference book, Vittoria said, an index of Bernini's work. If we can scan titles, maybe something will jump out.
I don't know, Langdon said.
If it's a work Bernini created specifically for the Illuminati, it may be very obscure. It probably won't be listed in a book.
Vittoria refused to believe it.
The other 2 sculptures were fairly well known. You'd heard of them both.
Langdon shrugged.
Yeah.
If we scan titles for references to the word fire, maybe we'll find a statue that's listed as being in the right direction.
Langdon seemed convinced it was worth a shot. He turned to Olivetti.
I need a list of all Bernini's work. You guys probably don't have a coffee table Bernini book around here, do you?
Coffee table book?
Olivetti seemed unfamiliar with the term.
Never mind. Any list. How about the Vatican Museum? They must have Bernini references.
The guard with the scar frowned.
Power in the museum is out, and the records room is enormous. Without the staff there to help.
The Bernini work in question, Olivetti interrupted. Would it have been created while Bernini was employed here at the Vatican?
Almost definitely, Langdon said.
He was here almost his entire career, and certainly during the time period of the Galileo conflict.
Olivetti nodded.
Then there's another reference. Vittoria felt a flicker of optimism.
Where?
The commander didn't reply. He took his guard aside and spoke in hushed tones. The guard seemed uncertain, but nodded obediently. When Olivetti was finished talking, the guard turned to Langdon.
"This way, please, Mr. Langdon. It's 9:15. We'll have to hurry."
Langdon and the guard headed for the door. Vittoria started after them.
"I'll help."
Olivetti caught her by the arm.
"No, Miss Vetra. I need a word with you."
His grasp was authoritative. Langdon and the guard left. Olivetti's face was wooden as he took Vittoria aside. But whatever it was Olivetti had intended to say to her, he never got the chance. His walkie-talkie crackled loudly.
"Comandante!"
Everyone in the room turned. The voice on the transmitter was grim. "I think you better turn on the television." Chapter 80. When Langdon had left the Vatican secret archives only 2 hours ago, he had never imagined he would see them again. Now, winded from having jogged the entire way with his Swiss Guard escort, Langdon found himself back at the archives once again. His escort, the guard with the scar, now led Langdon through the rows of translucent cubicles. The silence of the archives felt somehow more forbidding now, and Langdon was thankful when the guard broke it.
"Over here, I think,"
he said, escorting Langdon to the back of the chamber where a series of smaller vaults lined the wall. The guard scanned the titles on the vaults and motioned to one of them.
"Yes, here it is, right where the commander said it would be."
Langdon read the title. "Attivi Vaticani."
"Vatican assets?"
He scanned the list of contents. "Real estate, currency, Vatican bank, antiquities." The list went on.
"Paperwork of all Vatican assets,"
the guard said. Langdon looked at the cubicle. Jesus, even in the dark he could tell it was packed.
"My commander said that whatever Bernini created while under Vatican patronage would be listed here as an asset."
Langdon nodded, realizing the commander's instincts just might pay off. In Bernini's day, everything an artist created while under the patronage of the Pope became, by law, property of the Vatican. It was more like feudalism than patronage, but top artists lived well and seldom complained.
"Including works placed in churches outside Vatican City?"
The soldier gave him an odd look.
"Of course. All Catholic churches in Rome are property of the Vatican."
Langdon looked at the list in his hand. It contained the names of the 20 or so churches that were located on a direct line with West Ponente's Breath. The third Altar of Science was one of them, and Langdon hoped he had time to figure out which it was. Under other circumstances, he would gladly have explored each church in person. Today, however, he had about 20 minutes to find what he was looking for, the one church containing a Bernini tribute to fire. Langdon walked to the vault's electronic revolving door. The guard didn't follow. Langdon sensed an uncertain hesitation. He smiled.
"The air's fine. Thin, but breathable."
"My orders are to escort you here, and then return immediately to the security center."
"You're leaving?"
"Yes. The Swiss Guard are not allowed inside the archives. I am breaching protocol by escorting you this far. The commander reminded me of that."
"Breaching protocol? Do you have any idea what's going on here tonight? Whose side is your damn commander on?"
All friendliness disappeared from the guard's face. The scar under his eye twitched. The guard stared, looking suddenly a lot like Olivetti himself.
"I apologize," Langdon said, regretting the comment. I could use some help."
The guard didn't blink.
"I am trained to follow orders, not debate them. When you find what you're looking for, contact the commander immediately."
Langdon was flustered.
"But where will he be?"
The guard removed his walkie-talkie and set it on a nearby table.
"Channel 1.
Then he disappeared into the dark. Chapter 81.
The television in the office of the Pope was an oversized Hitachi hidden in a recessed cabinet opposite his desk. The doors to the cabinet were now open, and everyone gathered around. Vittoria moved in close. As the screen warmed up, a young female reporter came into view. She was a doe-eyed brunette. "For MSNBC News," she announced, "this is Kelly Horan-Jones, live from Vatican City." The image behind her was a night shot of St. Peter's Basilica with all its lights blazing.
"You're not live," Roche snapped. "That's stock footage. The lights in the basilica are out."
Olivetti silenced him with a hiss. The reporter continued, sounding tense.
"Shocking developments in the Vatican elections this evening. We have reports that two members of the College of Cardinals have been brutally murdered in Rome."
Olivetti swore under his breath. As the reporter continued, a guard appeared at the door, breathless.
"Commander, the central switchboard reports every line lit. They're requesting our official position on..."
"Disconnected," Olivetti said, never taking his eyes from the TV. The guard looked uncertain.
"But, Commander..."
"Go." The guard ran off. Vittoria sensed the Camerlengo had wanted to say something, but had stopped himself. Instead, the man stared long and hard at Olivetti before turning back to the television. MSNBC was now running tape. The Swiss guards carried the body of Cardinal Ebner down the stairs outside Santa Maria del Popolo and lifted him into an Alfa Romeo. The tape froze and zoomed in as the cardinal's naked body became visible just before they deposited him in the trunk of the car.
"Who the hell shot this footage?"
Olivetti demanded. The MSNBC reporter kept talking.
"This is believed to be the body of Cardinal Ebner of Frankfurt, Germany. The men removing his body from the church are believed to be Vatican Swiss Guard."
The reporter looked like she was making every effort to appear appropriately moved. They closed in on her face, and she became even more somber.
"At this time, MSNBC would like to issue our viewers a discretionary warning. The images we are about to show are exceptionally vivid and may not be suitable for all audiences."
Vittoria grunted at the station's feigned concern for viewer sensibility, recognizing the warning as exactly what it was, the ultimate media teaser line. Nobody ever changed channels after a promise like that. The reporter drove it home.
"Again, this footage may be shocking to some viewers."
"What footage?" Olivetti demanded. "You just showed..." The shot that filled the screen was of a couple in St. Peter's Square moving through the crowd. Vittoria instantly recognized the two people as Robert and herself. In the corner of the screen was a text overlay, courtesy of the BBC. A bell was tolling.
"Oh, no,"
Vittoria said aloud.
"Oh, no."
The Camerlengo looked confused. He turned to Olivetti.
"I thought you said you confiscated this tape."
Suddenly, on television, a child was screaming. The image panned to find a little girl pointing at what appeared to be a bloody homeless man. Robert Langdon entered abruptly into the frame, trying to help the little girl. The shot tightened. Everyone in the Pope's office stared in horrified silence as the drama unfolded before them. The cardinal's body fell face first onto the pavement. Vittoria appeared and called orders. There was blood, a brand, a ghastly failed attempt to administer CPR.
"This astonishing footage," the reporter was saying, "was shot only minutes ago outside the Vatican. Our sources tell us this is the body of Cardinal Lamassée from France. How he came to be dressed this way, and why he was not in conclave, remain a mystery. So far, the Vatican has refused to comment."
The tape began to roll again.
"Refused comment," Roche said. "Give us a damn minute."
The reporter was still talking, her eyebrows furrowing with intensity. "Although MSNBC has yet to confirm a motive for the attack, our sources tell us that responsibility for the murders has been claimed by a group calling themselves the Illuminati." Olivetti exploded.
"What?"
"Find out more about the Illuminati by visiting our website at..."
Non è possibile, Olivetti declared. He switched channels. This station had a Hispanic male reporter. A satanic cult known as the Illuminati, who some historians believe... Olivetti began pressing the remote wildly. Every channel was in the middle of a live update. Most were in English. Swiss guards removing a body from a church earlier this evening. The body is believed to be that of Cardinal... Lights in the basilica and museums are extinguished, leaving speculation. We will be speaking with conspiracy theorist Tyler Tingley about this shocking resurgence. Rumors of two more assassinations planned for later this evening. Questioning now whether papal hopeful Cardinal Baja is among the missing. Vittoria turned away. Everything was happening so fast. Outside the windows in the settling dark, the raw magnetism of human tragedy seemed to be sucking people toward Vatican City. The crowd on the square thickened almost by the instant. Pedestrians streamed toward them, while a new batch of media personnel unloaded vans and staked their claim in St. Peter's Square. Olivetti set down the remote control and turned to the Camerlengo.
Signore, I cannot imagine how this could happen. We took the tape that was in that camera.
The Camerlengo looked momentarily too stunned to speak. Nobody said a word. The Swiss guards stood rigid at attention.
It appears,
the Camerlengo said finally, sounding too devastated to be angry,
that we have not contained this crisis as well as I was led to believe.
He looked out the window at the gathering masses.
I need to make an address.
Olivetti shook his head.
No, signore. That is exactly what the Illuminati want you to do. Confirm them. Empower them. We must remain silent.
And these people?
The Camerlengo pointed out the window.
There will be tens of thousands shortly. Then hundreds of thousands. Continuing this charade only puts them in danger. I need to warn them. Then we need to evacuate our College of Cardinals.
There is still time. Let Captain Rocher find the antimatter.
The Camerlengo turned.
Are you attempting to give me an order?
No, I am giving you advice. If you are concerned about the people outside, we can announce a gas leak and clear the area. But admitting we are hostage is dangerous.
Commander, I will only say this once. I will not use this office as a pulpit to lie to the world. If I announce anything at all, it will be the truth.
The truth? That Vatican City is threatened to be destroyed by satanic terrorists? It only weakens our position.
The Camerlengo glared.
How much weaker could our position be?
Rocher shouted suddenly, grabbing the remote and increasing the volume on the television. Everyone turned. On air, the woman from NBC now looked genuinely unnerved. Superimposed beside her was a photo of the late Pope.
"Breaking information. This just in from the BBC."
She glanced off camera as if to confirm she was really supposed to make this announcement. Apparently getting confirmation, she turned and grimly faced the viewers.
"The Illuminati have just claimed responsibility for..." She hesitated. "They have claimed responsibility for the death of the Pope 15 days ago."
The Camerlengo's jaw fell. Rocher dropped the remote control. Vittoria could barely process the information.
"By Vatican law," the woman continued, "no formal autopsy is ever performed on a pope, so the Illuminati claim of murder cannot be confirmed. Nonetheless, the Illuminati hold that the cause of the late Pope's death was not a stroke, as the Vatican reported, but poisoning."
The room went totally silent again. Olivetti erupted.
"Madness! A bold-faced lie!"
Rocher began flipping channels again. The bulletin seemed to spread like a plague from station to station. Everyone had the same story. Headlines competed for optimal sensationalism. "Murder at the Vatican. Pope poisoned. Satan touches House of God."
The Camerlengo looked away. God help us. As Roche flipped, he passed a BBC station. Tipped me off about the killing at Santa Maria del Popolo. Wait, the Camerlengo said. Back. Roche went back. On screen, a prim-looking man sat at a BBC news desk. Superimposed over his shoulder was a still snapshot of an odd-looking man with a red beard. Underneath his photo, it said, Gunther Glick, live in Vatican City. Reporter Glick was apparently reporting by phone, the connection scratchy. My videographer got the footage of the cardinal being removed from the Chigi Chapel. Let me reiterate for our viewers, the anchorman in London was saying. BBC reporter Gunther Glick is the man who first broke this story. He has been in phone contact twice now with the alleged Illuminati assassin. Gunther, you say the assassin phoned only moments ago to pass along a message from the Illuminati? He did. And their message was that the Illuminati was somehow responsible for the Pope's death? The anchorman sounded incredulous. Correct. The caller told me that the Pope's death was not a stroke, as the Vatican had thought, but rather that the Pope had been poisoned by the Illuminati. Everyone in the Pope's office froze. Poisoned? The anchorman demanded. But how? They gave no specifics, Glick replied, except to say that they had killed him with a drug known as... There was a rustling of papers on the line. Something known as... heparin. The Camerlengo, Olivetti, and Roche all exchanged confused looks. Heparin? Roche demanded, looking unnerved. But isn't that... The Camerlengo blanched. The Pope's medication. Vittoria was stunned. The Pope was on heparin? He had thrombophlebitis, the Camerlengo said. He took an injection once a day. Roche looked flabbergasted. But heparin isn't a poison. Why would the Illuminati claim? Heparin is lethal in the wrong dosages, Vittoria offered. It's a powerful anticoagulant. An overdose would cause massive internal bleeding and brain hemorrhages. Olivetti eyed her suspiciously. How would you know that? Marine biologists use it on sea mammals, in captivity, to prevent blood clotting from decreased activity. Animals have died from improper administration of the drug. She paused. A heparin overdose in a human would cause symptoms easily mistaken for a stroke, especially in the absence of a proper autopsy. The Camerlengo now looked deeply troubled. Signore, Olivetti said, this is obviously an Illuminati ploy for publicity. Someone overdosing the Pope would be impossible. Nobody had access. And even if we take the bait and try to refute their claim, how could we? Papal law prohibits autopsy. Even with an autopsy, we would learn nothing. We would find traces of heparin in his body from his daily injections. True. The Camerlengo's voice sharpened. And yet something else troubles me. No one on the outside knew His Holiness was taking this medication. There was a silence. If he overdosed with heparin, Vittoria said, his body would show signs. Olivetti spun toward her. Miss Vetra, in case you didn't hear me, papal autopsies are prohibited by Vatican law. We are not about to defile His Holiness's body by cutting him open just because an enemy makes a taunting claim. Vittoria felt shamed. I wasn't implying. She had not meant to seem disrespectful. I certainly was not suggesting you exhume the Pope. She hesitated, though. Something Robert told her in the Chigi Chapel passed like a ghost through her mind. He had mentioned that papal sarcophagi were above ground and never cemented shut, a throwback to the days of the pharaohs, when sealing and burying a casket was believed to trap the deceased soul inside. Gravity had become the mortar of choice, with coffin lids often weighing hundreds of pounds. Technically, she realized, it would be possible to... What sort of signs? The Camerlengo said suddenly. Vittoria felt her heart flutter with fear. Overdoses can cause bleeding of the oral mucosa. Oral what? The victim's gums would bleed.
Post-mortem, the blood congeals and turns the inside of the mouth black. Vittoria had once seen a photo taken at an aquarium in London where a pair of killer whales had been mistakenly overdosed by their trainer. The whales floated lifeless in the tank, their mouths hanging open and their tongues black as soot. The Camerlengo made no reply. He turned and stared out the window. Rocher's voice had lost its optimism.
"Signore, if this claim about poisoning is true..."
"It's not true," Olivetti declared. "Access to the Pope by an outsider is utterly impossible."
"If this claim is true," Rocher repeated, "and our Holy Father was poisoned, then that has profound implications for our antimatter search. The alleged assassination implies a much deeper infiltration of Vatican City than we had imagined. Searching the white zones may be inadequate. If we are compromised to such a deep extent, we may not find the canister in time."
Olivetti leveled his captain with a cold stare.
"Captain, I will tell you what is going to happen."
"No,"
the Camerlengo said, turning suddenly.
"I will tell you what is going to happen."
He looked directly at Olivetti.
"This has gone far enough. In 20 minutes, I will be making a decision whether or not to cancel conclave and evacuate Vatican City. My decision will be final. Is that clear?"
Olivetti did not blink, nor did he respond. The Camerlengo spoke forcefully now, as though tapping a hidden reserve of power.
"Captain Rocher, you will complete your search of the White Zones and report directly to me when you are finished."
Rocher nodded, throwing Olivetti an uneasy glance. The Camerlengo then singled out 2 guards.
"I want the BBC reporter, Mr. Glick, in this office immediately. If the Illuminati have been communicating with him, he may be able to help us. Go."
The 2 soldiers disappeared. Now the Camerlengo turned and addressed the remaining guards.
"Gentlemen, I will not permit any more loss of life this evening. By 10 o'clock, you will locate the remaining 2 cardinals and capture the monster responsible for these murders. Do I make myself understood?"
"But, signore," Olivetti argued, "we have no idea where..."
"Mr. Langdon is working on that. He seems capable. I have faith."
With that, the Camerlengo strode for the door, a new determination in his step. On his way out, he pointed to 3 guards.
"You 3, come with me, now."
The guards followed. In the doorway, the Camerlengo stopped. He turned to Vittoria.
"Miss Vetra, you 2, please come with me."
Vittoria hesitated.
"Where are we going?"
He headed out the door.
"To see an old friend."
Chapter 82. At CERN, Secretary Sylvie Badaloc was hungry, wishing she could go home. To her dismay, Kohler had apparently survived his trip to the infirmary. He had phoned and demanded, not asked, demanded, that Sylvie stay late this evening. No explanation. Over the years, Sylvie had programmed herself to ignore Kohler's bizarre mood swings and eccentricities. His silent treatments, his unnerving propensity to secretly film meetings with his wheelchair's porta-video. She secretly hoped one day he would shoot himself during his weekly visit to CERN's recreational pistol range, but apparently he was a pretty good shot. Now, sitting alone at her desk, Sylvie heard her stomach growling. Kohler hadn't yet returned, nor had he given her any additional work for the evening. To hell with sitting here bored and starving, she decided. She left Kohler a note and headed for the staff dining commons to grab a quick bite. She never made it. As she passed CERN's recreational Suite de Loisir, a long hallway of lounges with televisions, she noticed the rooms were overflowing with employees who had apparently abandoned dinner to watch the news. Something big was going on. Sylvie entered the first suite. It was packed with biteheads, wild young computer programmers. When she saw the headlines on the TV, she gasped. Terror at the Vatican.
Sylvie listened to the report, unable to believe her ears. Some ancient brotherhood killing cardinals? What did that prove? Their hatred? Their dominance? Their ignorance? And yet, incredibly, the mood in this suite seemed anything but somber. Two young techies ran by waving T-shirts that bore a picture of Bill Gates and the message, "And the geek shall inherit the earth."
"Illuminati!" one shouted. "I told you these guys were real."
"Incredible. I thought it was just a game."
"They killed the Pope, man. The Pope."
"Jeez, I wonder how many points you get for that." They ran off laughing. Sylvie stood in stunned amazement. As a Catholic working among scientists, she occasionally endured the anti-religious whisperings, but the party these kids seemed to be having was all-out euphoria over the church's loss. How could they be so callous? Why the hatred? For Sylvie, the church had always been an innocuous entity, a place of fellowship and introspection, sometimes just a place to sing out loud without people staring at her. The church recorded the benchmarks of her life, funerals, weddings, baptisms, holidays, and it asked for nothing in return. Even the monetary dues were voluntary. Her children emerged from Sunday school every week uplifted, filled with ideas about helping others and being kinder. What could possibly be wrong with that? It never ceased to amaze her that so many of CERN's so-called brilliant minds failed to comprehend the importance of the church. Did they really believe quarks and mesons inspired the average human being? Or that equations could replace someone's need for faith in the divine? Dazed, Sylvie moved down the hallway past the other lounges. All the TV rooms were packed. She began wondering now about the call Kohler had gotten from the Vatican earlier. Coincidence? Perhaps. The Vatican called CERN from time to time as a courtesy before issuing scathing statements condemning CERN's research, most recently for CERN's breakthrough in nanotechnology, a field the church denounced because of its implications for genetic engineering. CERN never cared. Invariably, within minutes after a Vatican salvo, Kohler's phone would ring off the hook with tech investment companies wanting to license the new discovery.
"No such thing as bad press," Kohler would always say.
Sylvie wondered if she should page Kohler, wherever the hell he was, and tell him to turn on the news. Did he care? Had he heard? Of course he'd heard. He was probably videotaping the entire report with his freaky little camcorder, smiling for the first time in a year. As Sylvie continued down the hall, she finally found a lounge where the mood was subdued, almost melancholy. Here, the scientists watching the report were some of CERN's oldest and most respected. They didn't even look up as Sylvie slipped in and took a seat. On the other side of CERN, in Leonardo Vetra's frigid apartment, Maximilian Kohler had finished reading the leather-bound journal he'd taken from Vetra's bedside table. Now he was watching the television reports. After a few minutes, he replaced Vetra's journal, turned off the television, and left the apartment. Far away in Vatican City, Cardinal Mortate carried another tray of ballots to the Sistine Chapel chimney. He burned them, and the smoke was black. Two ballotings, no Pope. Chapter 83. Flashlights were no match for the voluminous blackness of St. Peter's Basilica. The void overhead pressed down like a starless night, and Vittoria felt the emptiness spread out around her like a desolate ocean. She stayed close as the Swiss guards and the Camerlengo pushed on. High above, a dove cooed and fluttered away. As if sensing her discomfort, the Camerlengo dropped back and laid a hand on her shoulder. A tangible strength transferred in the touch, as if the man were magically infusing her with the calm she needed to do what they were about to do. "What are we about to do?" she thought. "This is madness." And yet Vittoria knew, for all its impiety and inevitable horror, the task at hand was inescapable. The grave decisions facing the Camerlengo required information, information entombed in a sarcophagus in the Vatican grottos. She wondered what they would find. Did the Illuminati murder the Pope? Did their power really reach so far? Am I really about to perform the first papal autopsy?
Vittoria found it ironic that she felt more apprehensive in this unlit church than she would swimming at night with barracuda. Nature was her refuge. She understood nature. But it was matters of man and spirit that left her mystified. Killer fish gathering in the dark conjured images of the press gathering outside. TV footage of branded bodies reminded her of her father's corpse, and the killer's harsh laugh. The killer was out there somewhere. Vittoria felt the anger drowning her fear. As they circled past a pillar, thicker in girth than any redwood she could imagine, Vittoria saw an orange glow up ahead. The light seemed to emanate from beneath the floor in the center of the basilica. As they came closer, she realized what she was seeing. It was the famous sunken sanctuary beneath the main altar, the sumptuous underground chamber that held the Vatican's most sacred relics. As they drew even with the gates surrounding the hollow, Vittoria gazed down at the golden coffer surrounded by scores of glowing oil lamps. "Saint Peter's bones?" she asked, knowing full well that they were. Everyone who came to St. Peter's knew what was in the golden casket. "Actually, no," the Camerlengo said. "A common misconception. That's not a reliquary. The box holds palliums, woven sashes that the Pope gives to newly elected cardinals." "But I thought..."
"As does everyone. The guidebooks labeled this as St. Peter's tomb, but his true grave is two stories beneath us, buried in the earth. The Vatican excavated it in the 40s. Nobody is allowed down there."
Vittoria was shocked. As they moved away from the glowing recession into the darkness again, she thought of the stories she'd heard of pilgrims traveling thousands of miles to look at that golden box, thinking they were in the presence of St. Peter. "Shouldn't the Vatican tell people?"
"We all benefit from a sense of contact with divinity, even if it is only imagined."
Vittoria, as a scientist, could not argue the logic. She had read countless studies of the placebo effect, aspirins curing cancer in people who believed they were using a miracle drug. What was faith, after all?
"Change," the Camerlengo said, "is not something we do well within Vatican City. Admitting our past faults, modernization, are things we historically eschew. His Holiness was trying to change that." He paused. "Reaching to the modern world, searching for new paths to God."
Vittoria nodded in the dark.
"Like science?" "To be honest, science seems irrelevant."
"Irrelevant?" Vittoria could think of a lot of words to describe science, but in the modern world, irrelevant did not seem like one of them.
"Science can heal, or science can kill. It depends on the soul of the man using the science. It is the soul that interests me."
"When did you hear your call?"
"Before I was born."
Vittoria looked at him.
"I'm sorry. That always seems like a strange question. What I mean is that I've always known I would serve God. From the moment I could first think. It wasn't until I was a young man, though, in the military, that I truly understood my purpose."
Vittoria was surprised.
"You were in the military?" 2 years. I refused to fire a weapon, so they made me fly instead. Medevac helicopters. In fact, I still fly from time to time."
Vittoria tried to picture the young priest flying a helicopter. Oddly, she could see him perfectly behind the controls. Camerlengo Ventresca possessed a grit that seemed to accentuate his conviction rather than cloud it.
"Did you ever fly the Pope?" "Heavens, no. We left that precious cargo to the professionals. His Holiness let me take the helicopter to our retreat in Gondolfo sometimes."
He paused, looking at her.
"Miss Vetra, thank you for your help here today. I'm very sorry about your father. Truly."
"Thank you."
"I never knew my father. He died before I was born. I lost my mother when I was 10.
Vittoria looked up.
"You were orphaned?"
She felt a sudden kinship.
"I survived an accident that took my mother.
Who took care of you?
God, the Camerlengo said. He quite literally sent me another father. A bishop from Palermo appeared at my hospital bed and took me in. At the time, I was not surprised. I had sensed God's watchful hand over me, even as a boy. The bishop's appearance simply confirmed what I had already suspected, that God had somehow chosen me to serve him.
You believed God chose you?
I did, and I do.
There was no trace of conceit in the Camerlengo's voice, only gratitude.
I worked under the bishop's tutelage for many years. He eventually became a cardinal. Still, he never forgot me. He is the father I remember.
A beam of a flashlight caught the Camerlengo's face, and Vittoria sensed a loneliness in his eyes. The group arrived beneath a towering pillar, and their lights converged on an opening in the floor. Vittoria looked down at the staircase descending into the void, and suddenly wanted to turn back. The guards were already helping the Camerlengo onto the stairs. They helped her next.
"What became of him?"
she asked, descending, trying to keep her voice steady.
"The cardinal who took you in?"
"He left the College of Cardinals for another position."
Vittoria was surprised.
"And then, I'm sorry to say, he passed on."
"Le mie condoglianze," Vittoria said.
"Recently?"
The Camerlengo turned, shadows accentuating the pain on his face.
"Exactly 15 days ago. We are going to see him right now."
Chapter 84 The dark lights glowed hot inside the archival vault. This vault was much smaller than the previous one Langdon had been in. Less air, less time. He wished he'd asked Olivetti to turn on the recirculating fans. Langdon quickly located the section of assets containing the ledgers cataloging Belle Arti. The section was impossible to miss. It occupied almost 8 full stacks. The Catholic Church owned millions of individual pieces worldwide. Langdon scanned the shelves, searching for Gian Lorenzo Brennini. He began his search about midway down the first stack, at about the spot he thought the bees would begin. After a moment of panic, fearing the ledger was missing, he realized, to his greater dismay, that the ledgers were not arranged alphabetically. Why am I not surprised? It wasn't until Langdon circled back to the beginning of the collection and climbed a rolling ladder to the top shelf that he understood the vault's organization. Perched precariously on the upper stacks, he found the fattest ledgers of all, those belonging to the masters of the Renaissance, Michelangelo, Raphael, Da Vinci, Botticelli. Langdon now realized, appropriate to a vault called Vatican Assets, the ledgers were arranged by the overall monetary value of each artist's collection. Sandwiched between Raphael and Michelangelo, Langdon found the ledger marked Bernini. It was over 5 inches thick. Already short of breath and struggling with the cumbersome volume, Langdon descended the ladder. Then, like a kid with a comic book, he spread himself out on the floor and opened the cover. The book was cloth-bound and very solid. The ledger was handwritten in Italian. Each page catalogued a single work, including a short description, date, location, cost of materials, and sometimes a rough sketch of the piece. Langdon fanned through the pages, over 800 in all. Bernini had been a busy man. As a young student of art, Langdon had wondered how single artists could create so much work in their lifetimes. Later he learned, much to his disappointment, that famous artists actually created very little of their own work. They ran studios where they trained young artists to carry out their designs. Sculptors like Bernini created miniatures in clay and hired others to enlarge them into marble. Langdon knew that if Bernini had been required to personally complete all of his commissions, he would still be working today. "Index," he said aloud, trying to ward off the metal cobwebs. He flipped to the back of the book, intending to look under the letter F for titles containing the word fuoco, fire, but the F's weren't together. Langdon swore under his breath. What the hell do these people have against alphabetizing? The entries had apparently been logged chronologically, one by one, as Bernini created each new work. Everything was listed by date. No help at all. As Langdon stared at the list, another disheartening thought occurred to him. The title of the sculpture he was looking for might not even contain the word fire. The previous two works, Habakkuk and the Angel and West Ponente, hadn't contained specific references to earth or air. He spent a minute or two flipping randomly through the ledger in hopes that an illustration might jump out at him. Nothing did. He saw dozens of obscure works he had never heard of, but he also saw plenty he recognized. Daniel and the Lion, Apollo and Daphne, as well as a half-dozen fountains. When he saw the fountains, his thoughts skipped momentarily ahead. Water. He wondered if the fourth altar of science was a fountain. A fountain seemed a perfect tribute to water. Langdon hoped they could catch the killer before he had to consider water. Bernini had carved dozens of fountains in Rome, but most of them in front of churches. Langdon turned back to the matter at hand. Fire. As he looked through the book, Vittoria's words encouraged him. You were familiar with the first two sculptures. You probably know this one, too. As he turned to the index again, he scanned for titles he knew. Some were familiar, but none jumped out. Langdon now realized he would never complete his search before passing out, so he decided, against his better judgment, that he would have to take the book outside the vault. It's only a ledger, he told himself. It's not like I'm removing an original Galilean folio. Langdon recalled the folio in his breast pocket and reminded himself to return it before leaving. Hurrying now, he reached down to lift the volume, but as he did, he saw something that gave him pause. Although there were numerous notations throughout the index, the one that had just caught his eye seemed odd. The note indicated that the famous Bernini sculpture, The Ecstasy of St. Teresa, shortly after its unveiling, had been moved from its original location inside the Vatican. This in itself was not what had caught Langdon's eye. He was already familiar with the sculpture's checkered past. Though some thought it a masterpiece, Pope Urban VIII had rejected The Ecstasy of St. Teresa as too sexually explicit for the Vatican. He had banished it to some obscure chapel across town. What had caught Langdon's eye was that the work had apparently been placed in one of the five churches on his list. What was more, the note indicated it had been moved there per suggerimento dell'artista. By suggestion of the artist? Langdon was confused. It made no sense that Bernini had suggested his masterpiece be hidden in some obscure location. All artists wanted their work displayed prominently, not in some remote... Langdon hesitated. Unless... He was fearful even to entertain the notion. Was it possible? Had Bernini intentionally created a work so explicit that it forced the Vatican to hide it in some out-of-the-way spot? A location perhaps that Bernini himself could suggest. Maybe a remote church on a direct line with West Ponente's breath? As Langdon's excitement mounted, his vague familiarity with the statue intervened, insisting the work had nothing to do with fire. The sculpture, as anyone who had seen it could attest, was anything but scientific. Pornographic, maybe, but certainly not scientific. An English critic had once condemned the Ecstasy of St. Teresa as the most unfit ornament ever to be placed in a Christian church. Langdon certainly understood the controversy. Though brilliantly rendered, the statue depicted St. Teresa on her back in the throes of a toe-curling orgasm. Hardly Vatican fare. Langdon hurriedly flipped to the ledger's description of the work. When he saw the sketch, he felt an instantaneous and unexpected tingle of hope. In the sketch, St. Teresa did indeed appear to be enjoying herself, but there was another figure in the statue who Langdon had forgotten was there. An angel. The sordid legend suddenly came back. St. Teresa was a nun sainted after she claimed an angel had paid her a blissful visit in her sleep. Critics later decided her encounter had probably been more sexual than spiritual. Scrawled at the bottom of the ledger, Langdon saw a familiar excerpt. St. Teresa's own words left little to the imagination.
His great golden spear, filled with fire, plunged into me several times, penetrated to my entrails, a sweetness so extreme that one could not possibly wish it to stop.
Langdon smiled. If that's not a metaphor for some serious sex, I don't know what is. He was smiling also because of the ledger's description of the work. Although the paragraph was in Italian, the word fuoco appeared a half dozen times. Angel's spear tipped with point of fire. Angel's head emanating rays of fire. Woman inflamed by passion's fire. Langdon wasn't entirely convinced until he glanced up at the sketch again. The angel's fiery spear was raised like a beacon, pointing the way. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest. Even the type of angel Bernini had selected seemed significant. It's a seraphim, Langdon realized. Seraphim literally means the fiery one. Robert Langdon was not a man who had ever looked for confirmation from above. But when he read the name of the church where the sculpture now resided, he decided he might become a believer after all. Santa Maria della Vittoria. Vittoria, he thought, grinning. Perfect. Staggering to his feet, Langdon felt a rush of dizziness. He glanced up the ladder, wondering if he should replace the book. The hell with it, he thought. Father Jacques can do it. He closed the book and left it neatly at the bottom of the shelf. As he made his way toward the glowing button on the vault's electronic exit, he was breathing in shallow gasps. Nonetheless, he felt rejuvenated by his good fortune. His good fortune, however, ran out before he reached the exit. Without warning, the vault let out a pained sigh. The lights dimmed, and the exit button went dead. Then, like an enormous, expiring beast, the archival complex went totally black. Someone had just killed power.